Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Theo Linardusi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me again too. Again, Lucy, because you were away.
I was.
You left me.
I did, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm back now.
What did you do when you weren't here with me?
Oh, just all sorts of things. Bit of gardening, went to the seaside, bit of reading, surprisingly.
Well, you're going to have to say what now? I hope it's possible to share it.
Yeah, I read On Time and Water by Andri Magnusson, who is an Icelandic writer. And in fact, I read one of his others called Dreamland. And in fact, went to Iceland and met him and wrote about it in the TLS.
Oh.
In a piece which has afterwards become legendary in the office because I confidently expounded on the solid economy and general well-being of Iceland. I would say maybe 2 weeks before the whole thing collapsed. in the piece, I say, I can't remember what the number was, fourth most successful economy in the world, you know.
Beware any country that Lucy Dallas writes about.
Yeah, exactly. but it's a brilliant book. It's about, he was writing about environmental things then, but he was coming from being a kind of poet and much more literary, and now he writes much more about environmental things, but he writes from, there's a bit of personal and it's a bit mythical. He meets the Dalai Lama, has a long chat with him. He has two long chats with him actually, and there's lots of science, and he's trying to, he says at one point he meets a scientist at a climate conference who says, why aren't you talking about this? Why aren't you telling stories about this? And the author, Andri Magnusson, says, well, I'm not a scientist. I'm not, you know, qualified to tell people this. And the scientist says, yes, but we're not storytellers.
Mm.
And people aren't listening to us. It's difficult to listen to numbers.
Mm.
It's difficult to comprehend the scale. It's hard to communicate. And what you do is tell stories which people understand. So you have to tell it so that people understand it, so that, you know, so that people can do something about it.
And when was that? Because that is happening much more now than it was.
Yes, but so the book is quite recent. I think the paperback is just coming out now, but I think it's happening more than it was. But I think his point is that it needs to happen a lot more. Mm. And because he's in Iceland, actually, some of the stuff is just very. Is very clear and present. So they've lost a lot of valuable land because it's been given over to the smelting companies, which is what he was talking about 10 years ago or whatever.
And I wonder, I think as well, maybe if you live somewhere in, you know, in the shadow of a volcano, or, you know, near the continental divide, these things sort of, you can't help but see them and think about yourself in the context of
yes,
that.
Because he writes about glaciers a lot as well. And so he talks about his grandparents who used to go out on the glaciers and map them when nobody had. And now the glaciers are just getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So it's very clear, you know, it's very clear to him. Yeah. Mm. It's really good, though, because sometimes climate change works are so terrifying that you're just a bit paralysed. But it's not like that.
Sounds very interesting. So what was its title?
It's called On Time and Water.
Well, that sounds like a very worthwhile suggestion. Thank you very much, Lucy. Now, coming up on this week's show, the poet and composer Ivor Gurney spent most of his adult life forcibly constrained, first in the trenches of the Western Front, and then from 1922 until his death in 1937 in a lunatic asylum. Kate Kennedy, the author of A New Life of Gurney, will tell us how this confinement spurred him to express himself with a peculiarly direct, urgent intensity. And with Independent Bookshop Week just around the corner, we'd like to do some tub thumping. But first, to the Bengali polymath Rabindranath Tagore, the recipient in 1913 of the Nobel Prize in Literature. He was the first non-white and non-European to win the prize, in fact, which is in itself remarkable. And yet in most countries beyond his own, he is now the subject of extraordinary neglect. This week, Rasinka Chowdhury, the author of The Literary Thing, History, Poetry, and the Making of a Modern Cultural Sphere, reviews a brief biography of Tagore by Bashabi Fraser, part of a series called Critical Lives. But no summary in 200 pages, she says, can be expected to do justice to the vast, complex, and influential oeuvre of this poet, who was also a short story writer, dramatist, educationist, artist, songwriter, composer, and many other things. It is important, however, that his name be put into circulation in contemporary times to remind the world of Rabindranath Tagore yet again. Rosinka Chowdhury joins us from Calcutta now to do precisely that. Hello, Rosinka.
Hi.
So we need to be reminded of Tagore and all he stood for and achieved. So let's start at the beginning of the story and work our way through as best we can. Perhaps you could kick things off with a brief introduction as if to the Western man in the street.
Sure. So Rabindranath Tagore's family were and are still in the memory of Bengalis, a very important family. His grandfather was called Prince Dwarkanath Tagore. He was a businessman, a landowner, immensely rich, hugely successful. His father, on the other hand, was called Maharshi Devendranath Tagore. Maharshi as in Maharishi. To denote his religious turn, really, a sort of Oedipal turn against his father almost. Rabindranath was born in 1861 as the youngest child of 14 children. He came at the end of a long line of very, very distinguished brothers and sisters, novelists, composers, philosophers, artists. They were an extraordinary family, and their family history is extraordinary as well. The thing to remember about the family, though, just to note that they were, in fact, what were called Pirali Brahmins. That is, they had fallen from, they were considered to have lost their caste as true Brahmins. So in a sense, I only mention that because in a sense, they were always, that family were always outsiders in some sense to orthodox society, which may have in a way enabled their independence and daring in everything that they did in the 19th century. The other thing to mention in the context of this family and in the context of Rabindranath Tagore, within that family and outsiders, outside it, would be the city itself where this family was located, Calcutta, the city of modernity, the second city of the British Empire, an astonishing cultural production occurred in this city over the 19th century. This is sometimes called the Bengal Renaissance. But in any case, what is important is that it was at the time one of the great cities of the world, comparable to anywhere else in the world. The sad thing is that I don't think anybody but Bengalis are actually aware of the enormous achievements of the city at this time, of the city and its great men at this time.
And this man in particular, I suppose. I mean, so we have a very clear sense of a very literary family, and you say they were sort of outsiders. He was particularly precocious, wasn't he? I read somewhere that he wrote his first poems when he was still a child.
Yes, quite right. His first published poems were modelled on Chatterton. He actually mentioned Chatterton in a letter, and he said, except for the bit about the suicide, I quite like the idea. He pretended to be a medieval Bengali poet called Bhanu Singho, and he published this corpus of poetry that he called the Bhanu Singher Padavali. It was just a series of beautiful, luminous songs that survived to this day. Yes, and those were published when he was 16. And of course, the world for a while thought that an ancient, or rather a medieval manuscript had been discovered of immense beauty, until he said that, until he revealed that he had sort of written them himself. That was the inauguration of his career, literary fraud.
It's a great tradition, isn't it, of a literary fraud like that. I mean, it sounds as though, because he's got this extraordinary career in which, to us, he seems to be able to turn his hand to anything, but maybe within that time, and as you say, in that city, and even within that family, that was perhaps not quite so exceptional. If he was surrounded by composers and novelists, and this was what they did. He was a product very much, do you think, of that time and his family?
Yes, absolutely. It is true that his family was extraordinary. It is true that the city he lived in was in an extraordinary phase of cultural creativity. But it is also true that no one person actually encompassed so many different fields and genres. This is the thing. I mean, he had a brother who was a philosopher, a brother who was a composer, but they did the one thing, or at the most, two or three, they may have played the violin and written a play or two. But he was just vast.
And was it as a poet then that you first encountered him? Do you recall the circumstances and the experience of that first encounter?
So, you know, there is no first encounter in that sense. Like many others of my generation, I grew up surrounded by him, but not in the way that he's available now. Now he is around us as a national, almost an embalmed icon. But in my childhood, in the 1970s, much more vividly and personally present for us. My grandparents lived in Shantiniketan. My grandfather had returned with a DSc from Edinburgh in 1926. And he had retired as the Cairo Professor of Physics from Calcutta University. And he chose to go and live in Shantiniketan because he loved Rabindranath Tagore. So this is what they did at the time. He and his youngest brother, the artist Sudhiranjan Kastagir, they lived there. So that those surroundings are very familiar to me from frequent visits to them. So the houses with their distinctive low architecture, it is a particular architectural style. The surrounding landscape that he writes about so frequently in his poetry of vast open fields, ravines that are called the Khwai in Bengali, distant train tracks, red unpaved roads. These things are sculpted in my memory, really. And also my mother studied there for 2 years, from 1959 to 61. So she was trained in dance. So, and this is the thing that Rabindranath did. He emphasized that what he wanted to teach at his school and then college was to be outside of the colonial educational curriculum. He emphasized the arts, the fine arts, painting, music, dancing. This is what he gave precedence over, or at least equally to literary studies or studies in the humanities. And so the songs of the dance dramas that Tagore wrote, the Bhanu Shingar Padhavoli that I just mentioned, Chitrangoda, Shama, Chandalika, these are names every Bengali knows. So she would perform these on stage from time to time. And these records, these long playing records, would be playing on the home stereo. So really, in a sense, we grew up with him all around. We learned him in school. Later on, we read his novels and his mature poetry. So in a sense, he was everywhere, but in a way that I was not even aware of at the time. So, you know, discipline-wise, I was more interested in English literature growing up. That's what I studied. So all of this was in the background, really, which is what makes it so remarkable.
Obviously he has inspired everyone who has come after him from the sounds of it. So I wonder if you could tell us a bit about his own inspirations and influences, artistically or politically speaking. I know he traveled a lot.
That's a very interesting question, because he actually was the first modern poet, in a sense, who, when he was very young, 14, 15, tried to follow the style of the poets who had written in Bengali before him, who are now considered minor poets, really, and people who, whose names people don't remember very much anymore. He sort of turned against them to write in a form that was new and came in for some criticism at the time. So lyric poetry, really, that was very that was imbued with a sort of personal tone. And different in form from what had gone before. So really, he was doing something completely new with the poetry, which is why he was attacked, criticized, reviled, but also then slowly acknowledged.
Yeats came across his work, didn't he? A translation, which I think Tagore said wasn't much cop later on, but of the Gitanjali, is that right?
Yes.
And Yeats just thought this was wonderful and kind of pushed it on everybody he could and tried to spread the word as much as he could. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. That is exactly what happened. He took with him on the ship as he was traveling to England a small notebook of translations that he had begun in Eastern Bengal on his father's estates. And these he kept revising on the ship. Once he was hosted in London by the artist William Rothenstein, who introduced him to Yeats and the London literary circle. And it was Yeats, you're absolutely right, who was ecstatic about some of the translations that Rabindranath had done. He wrote in 1912, for instance, Yeats, that is, "These prose translations from Rabindranath Tagore have stirred my blood as nothing has for years," he said. He continued, "A whole people, a whole civilization, immeasurably strange to us, seems to have been taken up into this imagination. And yet we are not moved because of its strangeness, but because we have met our own image." So that's a quote from some of the many wonderful things Yeats said about the book of poems that became the Gitanjali that was published in London in 1912. And then, of course, reviewing it, Ezra Pound would compare Tagore to Dante. And yes, he was promoted by this group. And a year later, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for that book.
You tell the story of Wilfred Owen's mother as well. I mean, just to give a sense of this being a time when, as you say, everybody who read knew his name, Wilfred Owen's mother became familiar with him.
Yes, that is such an interesting story. If there's time, I can read you a little bit from the letter she wrote, Robindra.
Absolutely, that would be lovely.
Right, so she's writing this in August of 1920, when Tagore was in England. He receives this letter that is addressed to Dear Sir Robindranath, because by that time he has been knighted. Although, of course, in 1919, he returned that knighthood in protest over the Jallianwala Bagh massacre. But she does address him as Dear Sir Robindranath. And she writes, "I have been trying to find courage to write to you ever since I heard that you were in London. But the desire to tell you something is finding its way into this letter today. The letter may never reach you, for I do not know how to address it, though I feel sure your name upon the envelope will be sufficient. It is nearly 2 years ago that my dear eldest son went out to the war for the last time, and the day he said goodbye to me, we were looking together across the sun-glorified sea, looking towards France with breaking hearts, when he, my poet son, said those wonderful words of yours, beginning at," and she quotes, "when I go from hence, let this be my parting word," unquote. "And when his pocketbook came back to me, I found these words written in his dear writing with your name beneath. Would it be asking too much of you to tell me what book I should find the whole poem in?" So that was, of course, Susan Owen, mother of Wilfred Owen. And the verse was from the Gitanjali, as we know.
Could you just read us the rest of that, when I go from hence, because it's so beautiful. What it is that he's written down in the book?
Yeah, so it's a very short poem. I can read the entire poem. It's a sort of prose poem. I can read it. It's just a few lines. "When I go from hence, let this be my parting word, that what I have seen is unsurpassable. I have tasted of the hidden honey of this lotus that expands on the ocean of light, and thus I am blessed. Let this be my parting word. In this playhouse of infinite forms, I have had my play, and here have I caught sight of him who is formless. My whole body and my limbs have thrilled with his touch, who is beyond touch. And if the end comes here, let it come. Let this be my parting word."
And clearly we have now, an image of a man who not only was his work, his oeuvre, as you say, incredibly vast, but also it touched very many people. So, I mean, why is it that he has been, how did he go from being so known, so loved, to being so overlooked by so many now, do you think? I mean, clearly it's more than just a question of changing tastes, surely.
Yes. A number of things, really. Changing tastes, certainly. Part of the answer lies, for instance, in a phrase in this poem itself. In the second line that I read out, "I have tasted of the hidden honey of this lotus that expands on the ocean of light." Now, phrases like that, "hidden honey of this lotus that expands on the ocean of light," there were far too many of these sorts of phrases in the poems that he chose to translate later. I think he succumbed to the temptation to give the West, again, to give the Western world what it wanted, or what he thought it wanted. And that led to a fall in his reputation Among the modernists, Ezra Pound gave up on him completely. Yeats, in 1917, wrote to Macmillan, these later poems are drowning his reputation. And then again in 1935, he wrote to Rothenstein, I'm quoting from a letter from Yeats, damn Tagore. We got out three good books, Sturge Moore and I, and then because he thought it more important to see and know English than to be a great poet, he brought out sentimental rubbish and wrecked his reputation. So there was that. But Rabindranath was aware of the fact that he wasn't translating his works well. They weren't being translated well, and he wasn't translating his own works well. And he wasn't translating the right things, you know, if you ask me now, later, looking back, he translated the things he thought would be popular and would be wanted. But those were not at the core of who he was and what his poetry was. So maybe it will go on to be done. It hasn't been done successfully very much yet. There are poems that have been translated well, of course, but not enough.
And I think while we wait for these new translations, which will hopefully come, you say some are already underway. What we do have, and the reason for your review, we should say, is these two new books, which we can just touch on briefly before we'll have to let you go. But one of them is The Cambridge Companion to Rabindranath Tagore, edited by Sukanta Chowdhury. And that seems like a great book for anyone wanting to get a solid sense of his range of achievement and influence. And the other one is this Brief Life. Do you think it's possible that these will help to reinvigorate him, to kind of reintroduce him and do that important work for so many people who haven't grown familiar with him already?
Well, they certainly should. As you quite rightly say, Bashabi Fraser's biography is a short book, really. But these short books are often, useful and popular and travel more from hand to hand in a way that, say, a more compendious presentation like Andrew Robinson and Krishna Dutta's 1997 volume, The Myriad-Minded Man, which goes into about 500 pages, might not. So shorter books often accomplish what, the more compendious volumes don't. So in that sense, perhaps the biography will help. I hope it does. And The Cambridge Companion, edited by Sukanta Chowdhury, is really the best of its scholarship as it is available now. Sukanta Chowdhury was also general editor of the Oxford Tagore translations. There are five volumes of that between 2000 and 2006. He oversaw Bichitra, which is the Tagore Varorium that has brought everything Rabindranath wrote online, which is the most important resource nowadays in a sense. So there's a huge contribution there. And then now we have the latest offering, which is the Cambridge Companion. So yes, it's solid scholarship. It's immensely useful. It will be immensely useful to many, many scholars. And I'm sure it will survive as a guide and an aid to understanding Tagore's work over his lifetime.
But as you make clear, there is still plenty of work to do. Rasinka Chowdhury, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Still to come on the show, how Ivor Gurney's Great Pain transformed into a new kind of verse. And let's talk about independent bookshops. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free, wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And we are happy to announce the return of the exclusive TLS subscription offer. Exclusive, that is, to our podcast listeners. For just £5 or $5, or the equivalent in whatever currency you use, you will receive 6 issues of the TLS, and that's print and digital. So you'll have the paper turning up on your doorstep every week, where you'll find all the pieces we've talked about on this podcast, alongside dozens of other pieces, as well as getting access to everything online and in the app edition. Should you find yourselves waiting for a bus without your print issue handy. The digital access also includes the website and app archives and the historical archive, which goes back to 1902. So you can look up Walter de la Mare and T.S. Eliot and read what Virginia Woolf made of D.H. Lawrence, Joseph Conrad and Aldous Huxley. There's original writing by Roland Barthes, Saul Bellow, John Updike, Muriel Spark, Chinua Achebe, Patricia Highsmith, Umberto Eco and Susan Sontag, and poems by Hardy, Auden Frost, Plath, Larkin, Brodsky, Paul Muldoon and Anne Carson. So there's really quite a lot to be getting on with. Go to the-tls.co.uk/pod to take up this offer. Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we turn to the poet and composer Ivor Gurney, we wanted to remind listeners that Indie Bookshop Week, an initiative that celebrates independent bookshops in the UK and Ireland, is fast approaching. It begins on the 19th of June and typically involves events, readings, activities, prizes, launches, and that sort of thing. And the past 18 months have, of course, been particularly challenging for small businesses, so there's an especially strong sense of celebration and gratitude and probably relief for those who have made it, I suppose.
Yes, I'm sure there will be. Just to toot our own horn for a minute, we did try and help independent bookshops, the TLS did, by giving them free advertising. We just asked people to write in and tell us what they wanted to say, and we gave them free advertising in the paper.
And it ended up being a lovely directory, didn't it?
It was lovely, yeah. It was really nice. And they were very, some of them had really wonderful strap lines and descriptions and things. But Thea, can you remind me whose brilliant idea that was?
No, I can't.
Oh, I think I can remember. I'm pretty sure it was yours. Stop being so modest.
Anyway, in a similar spirit, though, we are asking you listeners to tweet us at the TLS or to send an email to letters@the-tls.co.uk nominating your local and or most cherished independent bookshop and telling us what you think sets them apart. I don't see why we need limit ourselves to the UK and Ireland, though. So nominate freely wherever you are. We'll read out as many as we can on that week's episode. So you have about 2 weeks to get in touch. And don't forget to let us know if you're happy to be named on the show along with your nomination. Lucy, would you like to get things started early?
Yes, I'm not going to nominate one because how can you nominate just one? I'm just going to do a sort of, can I do a bunch of them?
A scattergun approach to it.
Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking of them. There's a beautiful shop called The Golden Hare and one of the nicest streets that I can think of, St. Stephen Street in Edinburgh, on the way down to Stockbridge. It's very beautiful. If I remember, it's blue and gold, the shop, and it's got a lovely selection of stuff. London, there's Gaze the Word, which is an institution and has really, really good events very often. There's a bookshop just for children called Tales on Moon Lane in Herne Hill. That bookseller recommended to me the Mr. Gum series, which is genuinely one of the funniest things I've ever read. It is for children. But don't let that stop you. It's absolutely brilliant. The Nancy Mitford that we had been talking about a couple of weeks ago, Haywood Hill, I think must be the grandest independent bookshop, don't you think? Mm. I'm pretty sure it's got a warrant from the Queen. Nancy Mitford worked there while she was writing The Pursuit of Love.
Did she?
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. Because there's the bit in The Pursuit of Love where she's running a bookshop and they all come in and chat. And I think basically that's also
right. So it's method.
I think it was a bit. One that you would like, Thea, Village Books in Dulwich Village, which is a brilliant bookshop, but also very dog friendly. So if you took Alf in, they would give him a treat, I reckon. And one that I remembered from in Falmouth in Cornwall called Beowulf Books.
Yes, I will be there next week, in fact.
What, really? In Beowulf Books?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
What a weird coincidence. Yes,
that
I
is
will.
A weird coincidence.
I mean,
well,
they
brilliant.
Don't know that, but if they happen to listen, I'll see you in about a week's time.
There you go.
Well, I might save my nomination for the week itself. But one bookshop I have been intrigued by, I might mention, it opened at the end of April this year. So extra marks, I think, given the abysmal viral context in which this business has been launched. It's Hoxton Books at 99 East Street in East London. Have you seen this one, Lucy?
I have heard about it, I think. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it has a special focus on independent publishers, but it also tends to organise books by podcast. So say you'd go in and you'd find a books table with books that have appeared on this programme or the BBC's Start the Week, which seems a nice overlap. I suppose our table would probably be especially eclectic, I like to think.
Do we have a table? Do we genuinely have a table? We don't have
I don't know. Table. I'm not sure.
We might have like have one bit or something. That would be brilliant. No.
If not, could we have one, please?
I pleaded.
Yeah. Come on, Hoxton Books, give us a table. So, yes, send us your bookshops, listeners, and we will make a fuss over them in a few weeks' time. But now, Lucy, over to you.
Yes, we're going to talk about Ivor Gurney. So when you hear the name Ivor Gurney, you might think of him as one of the great war poets. And indeed he is. And he's commemorated at Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey as such. Gurney survived the First World War, but his best known work is still his war poetry because, sadly, he also suffered from mental illness and spent the last 15 years of his life in an asylum. He continued to write in the asylum, both music, as he was also a brilliant composer, particularly of songs, and poetry, but much of this work has been neglected or lost. His biographer, Kate Kennedy, who has written about Ivor Gurney for us this week, is here to tell us about this later work. Kate, thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure to be here.
Can you tell us about how, because we might be familiar with, the war poetry of Ivor Gurney. Can you tell us about how his poetry changed after he was put in the asylum?
Sure. So Gurney went to the war when he was an undergraduate. So really, his poetry was in its absolute infancy. And it developed very quickly, as it did for so many of the other war poets, you know, Wilfred Owen being the obvious example. As events developed for him during the war, he wrote to catch up with what he was experiencing. He then had about 4 years of the beginnings of a creative, mature voice after the war. And then the asylum happened to him. He was incarcerated in 1922. So really, he was just starting to emerge by the point at which he was locked up as an independent, fluent, poetic voice. So in a sense, we see that as the end of his life, and that there is this kind of writing in a vacuum from then onwards. But actually, the 15 years in the asylum until his death were the majority of his adult life. So his poetic style continues to develop. Interestingly, he's writing aside from the intellectual world of London. He's not under any pressure from any publishers, and he's not really in any kind of community. So it's a sort of terrible liberation in a sense. It was a disaster for him being in the asylum, but equally he could immerse himself in the poets he loved and Walt Whitman, Gerald Manley Hopkins, and take elements of their work and develop his own in directions that just didn't need to have the same kind of boundaries that perhaps other writers writing for the market, writing to be published, would impose on themselves. He could go in any direction, and he does. And his poetry in the asylum, most of which is still unpublished, is absolutely extraordinary and a very individual, independent, modernist voice.
And before we go into deeper into the quality, the nature of that poetry, what were the reasons for his confinement in an asylum? And what was he manifesting that meant that it was deemed necessary to keep him away from society?
Well, he'd had a breakdown as an undergraduate at the Royal College of Music before the war was declared, and he'd signed up in order to cure what he called his neurasthenia. So the cultural myth of Gurney is that he got shell shock and broke down as a result of the war, and that actually isn't really true at all. I mean, of course, the traumas that he endured on the Western Front weren't going to make him any happier, but actually, he joined because of the structure of the army and the discipline of it were elements that he'd already recognised would hold him together. So by 1922, he had started sitting with a cushion on his head to ward off the electrical waves that were interfering with him, he believed. He had voices in his head telling him to kill himself. He was going from police station to police station asking for a revolver. And of course, there's only so much of that you can do for so long. His brother, who potentially had similar issues of mental instability, it's very hard to tell from this distance, was very unsympathetic, and had a young family and certainly didn't have time for this kind of behaviour. And so ordered a magistrate and two GPs to his house Gurney was staying with him at the time, and they sat and read the paper and tried to look unassuming, and Gurney didn't know why they were there. And after a while, they were starting to say to his brother, Ronald, look, there's nothing wrong with him. Ivor seems fine. Until he made the mistake of going up to one of these men and saying, would you mind lending me a revolver so I can kill myself? And of course, that's enough to be certified. So he was certified suicidal, as much as insane, which actually is a category in itself. He's a danger to himself. And that's enough reason to have him put away. And he then ended up in Barnwood Asylum, a little private asylum just on the edge of Gloucester. And then after he tried to escape from there one too many times, was locked up in the much bigger county asylum called the City of London Mental Hospital, which is just off the Dartford estuary. So he was nearer his friends in London, but it was a much more secure, sort of a much larger institution that felt they could deal better with him.
If we're talking about because as you say, he continued to produce an enormous amount during that time. And it's incredibly difficult to unpick it, isn't it? Because maybe if he had had better mental health or even perhaps better treatment, I'm not sure, I think his treatment seems to have been, you know, up and down, certainly. He might have gone in the direction of modernism anyway. Or perhaps, as you said, the war, wouldn't be surprising if the war affected his work or his style as well as, you know, what he was experiencing. Is it very difficult to unpick what is owed to what?
Absolutely. I think he writes as the sum of his parts. He writes as someone who has experienced the world through landscape, through music. He has experienced the worst of the Western Front, and he's experienced total mental disintegration. He's been right to that brink two or three times and then back again. And he's now writing, with the world having forgotten him, writing to maintain his own sense of self for himself in the face of impending madness. So whichever one of those factors makes him a modernist, it would be impossible to say, but the combination of all of them makes for some absolutely fascinating verse. And I think Gurney never had any sense of boundaries at any point in his life. He would walk through the night, he would sleep under hedges. He thought across music and literature in a way that's almost unprecedented. So I think he would always have pushed further than the more conservative voices in music and literature. And it's so sad that we don't have much of that experimental work in print at the moment to really reflect what it was he had to offer us as a composer and a poet.
And another great pity of this is that a lot of the work has been lost, hasn't it? Songs as well as poetry.
Some has, yeah, absolutely. There were the archive is box load after box load of manuscripts, and his handwriting, of course, if you're writing for nobody, you can write as appallingly as you want and not date anything. And it's a minefield trying to negotiate your way around Gurney's archive. But there's a little note in one of the boxes saying these are representative of other patterns of incoherence, all of which are worthless and have been burnt. Now, what on earth was in that box? You know, it's who knows? And again, he had unlimited time, 15 years in an asylum with nothing else to do, no income to have to earn, no distractions, very, very few visitors. And so he wrote and wrote and wrote on a scale that most writers couldn't dream of. But much of it is very repetitious because nothing new is happening for him. He's mining his life up to the point of incarceration. So it is like a posthumous autobiography. And so the same patterns recur and recur. And we have to negotiate our way through all that and find different ways of reading what can be very similar documents. And it's almost like shuffling the same colours of the same patterns around in a kaleidoscope and just rearranging them slightly each time. He's trying out his favourite themes in each poem and each letter and then standing back and having a look at how they fit together and then writing it again in a slightly different way and standing back. And so it invites a different kind of reading. But to the people who've gone before, who had the very real practical problem of what to do with these thousands of bits of paper, some of this stuff just looks the same as everything else, or the same letters rehearsing the events of his life over and over and over again, patterns of incoherence. And yet, of course, the irony is that if it's a pattern, it's not incoherent. It is a pattern, and that's where the value lies.
When you say when you were talking about his handwriting, you said he was writing for nobody. Is that what you think? I mean, is that the impression that you get, that he was writing with no thought about being read by others, let alone, you know, published? Was it a personal project? Is there a sense of him trying to make sense of things? Is it a process?
Well, I believe he was writing for his life. He was writing because he was locked up, separated from the outside world. He was a patient who was a case study. His alternative biography was recorded by his doctors in his case notes, and it was not how he chose to identify himself, just, you know, the patient reports delusions, etc., etc. His weight and his height, these are not the statistics and the facts of his life that he chose to identify himself through. And so his poetry had to stand in for that. So there was a desperately urgent, very real personal need to express himself and to keep himself alive through his writing. Whether or not it was read, I think in some ways was a secondary concern for him. His project always was a relationship to Gloucestershire. I mean, it's wonderfully eccentric in himself. He was a maker, he described himself, and he wanted to honour Gloucestershire. And honour is a word that crops up with many interesting meanings for Gurney over and over again. And so he's writing to shape the landscape through his words and to express his love for it and what it's meant to him. And so in a sense, it's the hills that are listening. It's not people. But he is, you know, there is a trickle of poetry being published in various journals and papers. The BBC are performing some of his songs at various points. 3 or 4 years into his incarceration, he edits his own manuscripts because they're about to be performed. But actually, his edits don't make it into the performance. So in a sense, he's half talking to people, but they're not necessarily listening. And many of his letters are never published. They're not published at all, but they're not posted. So there is a very sad sort of subset of the archive that are hundreds upon hundreds of letters to often recipients who aren't even possible. So to the army of Bapaume, or to the women of New England, or to the Metropolitan Police. I mean, what postcode do you put on any of those? And they are him, again, as I say, rehearsing the events of his life, kind of standing by his CV, saying, this is who I am, this is who I was, this is me up to the present. Help me, release me, or give me chance of death, is his recurring phrase. I appeal for release or chance of death. And you pull these out of the envelopes for the first time and unfold them for the first time, and there's no stamp. And so his voice is not getting through, it isn't being heard. And there's something so desperately sad about that. Someone whose identity is so utterly invested in their ability to communicate through their pen, and finding that you're possibly one of the first people to read this correspondence that has never got further than the asylum.
It must have been, aside from the, of course, it's very valuable work to bring it to light, but it must have been heartbreaking working through all that material.
It really was. It really was. One of the particular moments for me, I think, were knowing how much store Gurney put by his ability to communicate and by his, you know, by the pen. Yeah, of course, you know, the cliche is the pen is the tool of your trade as a writer. But for him, it was his voice and it was his power. And he despised pencil. He's very rude about people who write in pencil. And then I found that in 1922 and early 23, when he's just been put in the asylum, for months his manuscripts are all in pencil. And I was scratching my head about this, thinking, well, that's very un-Gurney. Perhaps they didn't allow, I don't know, did they not give him a pen? How weird. And then read in a mental hospital manual of the time, as I was sort of, you know, snuffling around in archives and finding out everything I possibly could about what life was like in the asylum, that actually if you were labelled suicidal, which was his status, and you were what was called on parchment, which meant that you had effectively a clipboard at the end of your bed saying, do not take your eyes off this patient, follow them everywhere, you weren't allowed a pen nib because you would slash your wrists with it. And so what was his only link to the outside world, even though those letters weren't getting posted, was a pen. He'd been infantilized. He'd have it taken off him, and he was writing in pencil because that was all he was allowed, probably eating with a spoon, followed into the toilet because a U-bend is a prime spot for hangings, we're told in this mental hospital manual, followed around a concrete square by an attendant instead of being able to roam the Gloucestershire landscape. And so just from that little, the materiality of that little detail, seeing these pencil marks, a whole other picture emerges of just the degradation of it and the indignity and what this change in status must have felt like to him, to go from total freedom, however deranged, however, you know, however impossible he was finding life, to being this sort of child prisoner, very much against his will.
He did have some encouragement, didn't he, and understanding. As you say, he had some visitors and a little bit of his work. Sort of, there was still some interest in his work, but there was also a lot of neglect fair to say, harsh treatment, wasn't there?
There was, and in some ways, you know, if you are locked up for 15 years, you can't really blame the outside world for forgetting about you, particularly when you don't have relatives or much money outside the asylum walls being able to promote your reputation. But there were a few very, very loyal followers. I learned at one point that Vaughan Williams, who'd been his teacher when he returned to the Royal College after the war, actually came into the asylum really quite regularly, which is incredible because he was a really busy man. He had a huge career and many other demands on his time, but he would go to visit Gurney in Dartford and take other musicians from the Royal College and play through some of his songs. So there is a counter to this this image of him writing into silence, writing in isolation. And that is very much true. That would have been his experience. But equally, there was this incredible sort of ad hoc outreach scheme from the college coming in. There's Vaughan Williams playing through these songs. So when we're looking at these manuscripts thinking, well, that's a bit odd, that's a strange key change here, this could very well have been something that Vaughan Williams had played and found to be perfectly acceptable. And again, we have to be very, very careful about how we assess the, in inverted commas, mad music, because it was being played. It was being played by the greatest, most interesting musicians around at the time.
Yes, it's the same, isn't it, for music? I was thinking if you put quite a lot of Charles Ives in front of anyone who's never heard it before, they just go, what on earth is going on here? You know, actually, well, I mean, they did do that to him, but he wasn't locked up is what I mean. You know, it's the context is very, very important, isn't it? I suppose is the point.
It is, and avoiding it's such a minefield, you know, what you do with mental instability and creativity and the links between them, and the which can be a very creative space, but the difficulties of that space as well. You know, do you with late Schumann writing in an asylum, do we not allow late Schumann's works to be published or to be performed in case they taint his reputation? Late Beethoven's pretty crazy, but he made quite a name for himself. So
I was thinking about that because I thought of Schumann, but I thought Schumann didn't write very much after he was in.
No,
he did. A little bit, did he?
Well, not anything like as much as Gurney, but it was the voices in his head inspiring him. You know, that's pretty textbook.
It's, and of course, he thought he was Beethoven for a while, didn't he?
Exactly. All the best mad composers did. You see, there is a precedent for it.
Mm. And so you say that he is in fact a major and overlooked presence in English modernism. Do you think he might now get more recognition? I think your book on him is coming out this month, isn't it?
That's right. So my book, Dweller in Shadows, which is takes a quote from one of Gurney's poems, comes out on the 15th of June. And I've been making a documentary with BBC Radio 3, which comes out on Sunday the 20th, the Sunday feature, which is called Unmouthed, taking a little quote of Gurney's on a scrap of paper in the archive where he looks at music scores and calls them poor unmouthed creatures because he can't hear the music. I would love for Gurney to take his place alongside the more canonical modernists. The very practical difficulty is that the vast majority of his modernist work is not yet in print, so it's very hard for anybody to assess this stuff. That is being worked on. Oxford University Press are very slowly bringing out a number of volumes of the asylum poetry, and so in a decade this will hopefully look very different. But I hope that the research that I've done over far too many years on Gurney's archive and on this unseen material will at least sort of pave the way for future research.
We'll see you back here in a decade then.
I'll write it in the diary now. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kate Kennedy. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
that is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Kate Kennedy and Rosinka Chowdhury. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.